Hey everybody, we're back and happy new year. This is the last podcast of the year of 2023. We have Charles E. Rankin on the phone, and he'll be talking about a book that he's written that I can't wait to hear the story of it and to hear Charles' story as well. But again, happy new year. I appreciate everybody listening on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, iHeartRadio, wherever you're grabbing this content. I appreciate it. As always, please leave a rating and a review. That helps with distribution. I also want to thank my friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, one of Arizona's longest running newspapers. You can find the Tombstone Epitaph at tombstoneepitaph.com. And that is Wild West history in a newspaper format delivered right to your door so you can read it. It's about 20 pages, and it's Western history, true provenance, with pictures and articles and book reviews. And Eric and Mark are killing it out there. And be sure to subscribe and get it delivered to your door by going to tombstoneepitaph.com. And I want to thank my second family at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. That's wildwesthistory.org. And 2024 Roundup is going to be at Fort Smith, Arkansas. And we would love to see you in Fort Smith. If you'd like to go and be a part of the Roundup and learn all about Fort Smith history, please go to wildwesthistory.org. Go down to the membership spot, join, become a member, and you'll get the journal 4 times a year delivered right to your door. Fantastic journal. You're going to love it when you get it and read it. You're going to end up keeping them like I'm keeping mine. And that is at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. So Charles came to me through our continued relationship from Sarah Key over at University of Nebraska Press. Sarah Key, I want to thank her a bunch. She is super great. She helps all the writers that have a book out through University of Nebraska Press by getting out the advertising. This is how we connected. And a huge thanks to Sarah Key for doing that. Charles has been around. He's got an insane background. Welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm very good, Mike. Doing well today.
You've been around a bunch because you and in our pre-interview, you and I have spoken about that we have chatted before on the phone when you used to work for University of Oklahoma Press. How long did you work there, and how are you enjoying, or how do you like retirement?
I worked for the University of Oklahoma Press for 16 years. I went there in 2000 and retired in 2016, but then continued on for about 2.5 years in a part-time role, which the university allowed a retired staff member to do. And I loved it. It was a wonderful opportunity. I got to work with an awful lot of very talented people, and it was a continuation of what I'd done before, which was as director of publications at the Montana Historical Society for 11 years before that. And we not only published a magazine there, but we also did books. And so one kind of led to the other.
Well, your past background is all about history. You were the director of publications for Montana Historical Society. You were also the editor of the Montana the Magazine of Western History. You had your doctorate from, you got your doctorate, you're busy, busy guy, from University of New Mexico in 1994. And then you've written a lot of books besides the one we're going to talk about today. The one that we're talking about today is Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. Then you have written all sorts of books, including Recollections of the Civil War, Ladies' Choice, Ethel Waxham Journals, Trails Towards a New Western History, Wallace Stegman, Man and Writer, and then Legacy, A New Perspective on the Battle of Little Bighorn. Plus, you've wrote all sorts of articles for the Montana magazine. Like, where do you find time? Like, you're doing all of this. Where do you find time to do all this?
Well, you just kind of pick up opportunities. And that's the way it was, particularly for, I suppose one good example would be the, Wallace Stegner, Man and Writer. We put together, with, partners at the University of Montana, we did a symposium on Wallace Stegner shortly after he died in 1993. And we invited in many really talented people, and they gave some wonderful presentations that we then recruited from them as essays. And we then put that together with a few other essays and put it together as a book. And so as an editor at Montana and then at the University of Oklahoma Press, it just puts you in touch with a lot of different, like I say, very talented, skillful people who then are eager to have their material published as well. So you can kind of combine them into books that the people want to read.
Well, how did you get into this? Did you have a family member or a father or a grandfather that got you into Western history, Civil War history, becoming an author? What was your the guiding light for you to go down the direction that you are today?
Well, actually, my undergraduate degree is in journalism. And which has always been referred to as history quick and dirty. But I was a journalist, a newspaper journalist, for the first 10 years of my career. And I did a little radio while I was also during that time. But ultimately, journalism, I kind of moved up into editorial positions in the newspapers, and frankly, Mike, I got a little bored, and so I was in Fort Collins, Colorado at the time, and started picking up history courses at the university there, Colorado State University, and one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I'd thrown over my day job and went back to school and got my master's degree in history at Colorado State. And while I was there, the journalism department and I found each other. And so I had the opportunity to teach journalism 1 year part-time and then another year full-time at Colorado State University while I was working on the master's degree, and loved it. And so I went to the University of New Mexico looking to get what's called your union card, your PhD, so I could teach at the college level. And so I went down to the University of New Mexico. I was there for not quite 5 years. And the opportunity then came along. I never quite got away from editing. I worked for the New Mexico Historical Review while I was there in Albuquerque. And then got the opportunity to come to Montana, a place that I had never been, in Helena, to become director of publications at the Montana Historical Society. One thing just sort of led to another. And like I say, at the Historical Society, we were doing more and more books and putting ourselves in competition with university presses. And I knew the director at the University of Oklahoma Press, and he and I competed particularly for one book by Jerry Green and on the Nez Perce War. And I convinced Jerry to publish it with the Montana Historical Society, and the director down at the University of Oklahoma Press said, well, enough of this. Why don't you just come down here and work? And so he made an offer I couldn't refuse.
So if you're wondering who we're talking to, we're talking to Charles Rankin. He's written a book called The Civil War Letters of Frederick. And he actually, let me back up, Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. You can find it at Amazon and booksellers near you. It's got around 425 pages, sells for about $35. And you're going to want to get this one because when we did the pre-interview, I can't wait to work my way to getting over to read it because it's such an intriguing story. Again, the book is called Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. You can find it at booksellers and Amazon near you at around $35. $35, and it's got about 425 pages. And I want to thank Sarah Key at University of Nebraska Press. So your book, you've written all these other books that were out there. You've written a new one. This one was, what was the release date on this? It was just recently, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in May of this year.
May of this year. And so you've written all these other books. How did this one come about that you, because you had told me that the letters were at the Huntington Library, correct?
That's right.
And that, how did you work your way around to getting into these letters that, and before we talk about Frederick and his wife and the letters that they wrote to each other, How did you come around to it? How did this, because this wasn't something that you were normally writing about. Most of your books are in different subjects. And here you are into a Civil War book between letters between a married couple over a 3-year period. How did this come about?
That's a very good question, Mike. When I was working on my dissertation for the degree at the University of New Mexico, I had the opportunity through Paul Hutton and Martin Ridge to go to the Huntington Library. And what I was thinking was to try to combine my interests between journalism and history. And so I was looking for journalists, newspaper men who had worked in the American West, probably in the latter half of the 19th century. And so in looking for those people, I found Frederick Lockley, whose collection also includes quite a bit of material about his career after the Civil War as a newspaper man in the American West in various places. Getting into his papers, which are fairly extensive, I found these Civil War letters. Now, this is all back in the 1990s, and you indicated how on earth did I do so much. I don't feel like I did as much as I could have because I actually worked on those letters in the 1990s, but then wrote a dissertation on Lockley's career in the American West, and that's what I did for the degree. But I always knew those Civil War letters were there, and I knew they were good because I had actually had them microfilmed, and I had keyboarded them, and I knew what all was there. I just never quite found the time to work on them until I retired. And then once I did, then I got back into them, and that's what led me into the Civil War era and the book that this just published this year from Nebraska.
So now your statement, your answer is going to drive me. And if you're wondering who we're talking to Charles Rankin, and for people who might be hearing me the first time, I have no pre-made questions. Every question that I come up with or ask is because the person on the phone that we're interviewing will say something that I'm just like, oh my God, I got to find out more. Your answer is very unusual in the sense that you had the opportunity that you researched things in the 1990s by looking at microfiche or film. What was it? Microfilm.
Microfilm.
Microfilm. You cataloged this information, and then returned in the 2020s, and then continued it of your research. So you not only used the old school ways, but the new school ways. How was that joining the two together? How was it? Did you have to go back into the microfilm and start over again? Or did you have enough catalog information that when you started using the computer that you were able to mesh the two?
Again, a very good question, Mike, because I was faced exactly with that. For one thing, yes, I still have the microfilm, which the Huntington made for me. But over the course of 20 years, I didn't have the microfilm reader anymore. But what I had done was I had actually keyboarded all the letters and printed out versions of them. I had them all in essentially 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. And so I had that much. And then because technology had moved along the way it had, I could actually send the microfilm reels that I had off to a specialty place that could convert them all into PDFs, which was a godsend because once I got them in PDFs, PDFs are searchable, and so I could look for certain things, or I had them all right there on my computer screen. And so then I could compare what I had typed up in the 1990s with what I was seeing 20 years later. And I made another couple of trips to the Huntington Library, which is in San Marino, California, the Los Angeles area, because questions arose as to the PDFs were good and the microfilm was good, but not as good as looking at the original letter. And so I was able to go back to the Huntington and verify places in the letter that were not clear. And so anyway, it was kind of a back and forth effort in order to pull it all together.
So are the letters then sitting at the Huntington Library? Are the original paper letters in microfilm only, or are they, could you physically put on like soft gloves that your oils of your hand wouldn't get on the paper and actually open them up and read them?
Yes. Oh, they are in the originals in archives boxes at the Huntington. And the paper, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, the paper they used had a high linen content. And so they're actually very well preserved. And not very many are written in pencil. Most are written in ink. And so they're in very good shape.
Wow. So when you held them in your hand, was that, to me, I would have been like awestruck. Was it that way for you, or do you look at them like, I'm not a writer, so I would look at them like I'm holding, you know, something that, you know, during the Civil War, which touched between the two of them. Did you feel that way, or because
it does move you? Yes,
it does.
To be able to hold the letter that was actually mailed from one to the other, and preserved. I think we talked about this maybe about a week ago. During the Civil War, historians estimate that more than a billion letters were written by soldiers and by families and that kind of thing. Many of those have not survived. Particularly the ones written by the soldiers, by the families of the soldiers. The soldiers' letters were more apt to be preserved because they were sent home. And whether it was the wife or the daughter or the girlfriend or the mother of the soldier, They preserved them. They had a place to put them. They could put them in a box or in a drawer or somewhere and could keep them safe. However, the family's letter sent to the soldier, well, he's in the field. And it was very difficult for him to hang on to them and or hang on to very many of them. And most soldiers did not. And so consequently, one of the real pluses with the Lockley letters is that there are over 400 of them, and about 290 of them are from Frederick to Elizabeth. But about 115, not quite 120 of them, are from Elizabeth to Frederick. And he was able to preserve her letters and then take them home after the war. And then she hung on to them faithfully over the years. And essentially, they were then given to their son, who then donated them to the Huntington Library.
That is so awesome. That is crazy. I was going to ask you, how did they get to the library? And you answered it. That is just crazy.
Well, that in itself, Mike, is a bit of a story because Lockley had Frederick and Elizabeth had five children between them, and only one was a son, and his name was Fred or Frederick. He didn't go by a junior, but he did go by Fred Lockley. He is well known as a historical personage in Oregon, mainly because that's where he became a newspaper man himself. He traveled the state. He not only reported on things around the state, but he also solicited for the newspaper. And as he did so, he collected historical material. From the small towns and the people around Oregon, and became a rare bookseller. And so he was in correspondence with the Huntington Library and other libraries as well, as early as the 1920s, and then and sold them rare books that he had collected in his travels around Oregon. And by the 1940s, he started showing the Huntington some of these Civil War letters. The library actually paid for a few of them, less than $5 a piece at the time. But eventually then Fred, the son, his health began to decline during the 1950s. And in the late 1950s, he donated the entire collection to the Huntington Library.
You had mentioned earlier that when you started your research in the 90s, that Frederick was a newspaper man, correct?
Correct.
And that is a story in itself. Do you have enough information about Frederick in his life before and after the Civil War to write a book about him?
Most definitely do, and in fact, I'm under contract with the University of Nebraska Press to write a follow-on biography after the Civil War letters book on his career as a Western newspaper man. And he actually, his collection is quite extensive, made so not the least because he wrote his own memoirs late in life. He suffered a stroke in 1899 that paralyzed his left hand, his left arm. He was left-handed. But growing up, he had learned to write with his right hand. And his son encouraged him to write his memoirs, and he did. And those are also part of the Huntington collection, 1,200 pages of handwritten memoir, about not quite a third of which, between a quarter and a third of which, actually relate to the Civil War, a fair amount to his lifetime prior to the Civil War. Keep in mind that when he enlisted in 1862, he was 38 years old. And so he's been around. He was born in London and immigrated to the United States in 1848. Lived in a number of different places, mostly in the New York City area during the 1850s, and then enlisted in the Union Army in 1862 and served until 1865. His regiment, the 7th New York Heavy Artillery Regiment, which was actually in fairly safe circumstances in defense of Washington for the first 2 years that he was a soldier. But then Ulysses S. Grant called up those heavy artillery regiments to man his Army of the Potomac when he invaded Virginia in 1864. And Frederick's regiment was part of that, and they were literally destroyed. Not very many of the original regiment survived. Frederick, however, did, and he was very lucky that he did. And so after the war, he went back to Albany, New York. He didn't stay around very long. He bought a train ticket to Chicago, where he had visited in the 1850s. But he stopped off in Cleveland, found a job on a newspaper there, and worked in Cleveland for 3 years. Then moved to Leavenworth, Kansas, and he worked there for a little less than 3 years, reporting on Indian Territory. He would travel through Oklahoma, what is Oklahoma today, Indian Territory then, and reporting on conditions there, and as well as in the settlement of Kansas in the early 1870s. In 1873, he and two others had the opportunity to go to Salt Lake City and operate the Salt Lake Tribune, which is still publishing today. And the Salt Lake Tribune at the time had been founded by a number of Salt Lake City businessmen who disagreed with Brigham Young and his economic policies. And so it was more or less an anti-Mormon newspaper in Salt Lake City in 1873 when Lockley and his two cohorts from Kansas took it over. And quickly they were allowed to purchase the newspaper. And he was the chief editor of the chief anti-Mormon newspaper in Salt Lake City from 1873 to 1880. And in 1880, then he decided that he had enough of newspapering, and he went up to Walla Walla, Washington, and bought a farm. And he, as his son later said, as a farmer, my father was a good newspaper editor. He sprinkled around a lot of money and like that, but grew bored. And then before he knew it, he had accepted a job to become editor of a brand new Republican newspaper in Butte, Montana, which of course.
No, wait, hold on a second. Hmm? Is this all going to be in your next book?
Yeah.
Listen, you can't give it away. I've got to cut you off because honestly, we haven't even spoken about the letters yet. And if I let you go, you'll tell about the next book, because now that I know you're under contract with University of Nebraska Press and Sarah, like Sarah and I, we're not going to tolerate you screwing around. So you need to get this second book done.
Okay.
We're not going to tolerate you messing around. You got too much free time on your hand up in Montana. I know it sounds stupid. He's like, how do you know that? Well, I know. But I don't want you to give away everything on the second book.
Oh, I'm not really giving it away, Mike. Just to round out the story.
Okay, then round it out. I don't want you to give away everything.
He goes back to Kansas and he tries to run a weekly newspaper That doesn't work out too well. And ultimately he goes out to Salem, Oregon, and buys into a newspaper and then draws out and retires. And then eventually passes away. In the early 20th century. So essentially he was born and raised in London, England, and then came to the United States, was on the East Coast for a lot of the pre-Civil War era, and then pinballed, if you will, across the American continent, working as best he could at newspapers along the way, and wound up on the West Coast.
Okay. Well, like I said, don't give it away, because me and you in UMP, we're not going to tolerate you screwing around and not writing that book, because now I can't wait to read it.
Good.
So dumb. We're talking to Charles Rankin, Charles E. Rankin. He's written a book called Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. You can find it at Amazon and booksellers near you for around $35. It's about 425 pages, so you got a solid book of some solid reading. When I had read a little bit about Frederick, that that he had multiple, I'm going to back up, before the Civil War, what was he doing before the Civil War? Because he had a full career, and then he got into where I read that he had multiple job assignments, including guarding Union parolees and Confederate prisoners of war.
He was the son of a butcher, and had what he called that ungentle craft. And he hated it. He didn't like being a tradesman. He wanted to read. He wanted to become. His true passion was literature. He self-taught and didn't get through and. A lot of schooling in London, but he was extraordinarily well read. All the great authors of the time, as well as Shakespeare and the various poets and historians, French and English both, and the poets. He in fact wrote some poetry, which is at the Huntington. And that was his passion. But as he grew older, he tried different things, but he never could escape the butcher's trade because he knew how to do that. And it was a way to make money. And so finally, he got fed up with England and immigrated to the United States in 48 and bounced around quite a bit. He took a flatboat down with cattle down the Mississippi River to New Orleans. That was his first encounter with slavery. He didn't like it, but he then wound up back in New York, where he married his first wife, and in 1851, and had a good marriage, but he was still bouncing around with various kinds of jobs, like a lot of people did during that time. The marriage was very stable. They had three children, the first Josie in 1853, and then Dolly in 1855, and then Gertie in 1857. They came right along. And so they're very young girls. And in 1859, his wife then developed a certain paralysis in her arms, and eventually it spread to her legs. She died in 1860. And the autopsy showed that she had a tumor next to her spine, and that was what was what had caused her death. So there Lockley is. He's in his mid-30s. He's got three little girls, and so one of his first wife's sisters comes and lives with them to help take care of the girls. He's still looking for various kinds of work, and he's a book salesman, door-to-door. Upstate New York, and then happens by a place called Schuylerville and sees a woman in a window and just falls in love with her and finds reasons to go to the door and attempt to make a sale of a book. And she is living with her aunt and her grandmother. And he then gets to know them and through them tries to wants to court her. She was not really alive to it at first because she's actually 17 years younger than he is. And she's only 17 years old at the time. And so, but nonetheless, it's a relatively short courtship, mostly through correspondence, which as some of which is at the Huntington and some of which is at the New York Public Library. And they were married then in February, the last day of February of 1861. And he holds back from the war, although he was a naturalized American citizen as of 1859, and he feels an obligation to go fight for his country, for the Union. He feels very strongly about that, but he also feels that he's not, you know, it's not necessary. There are others who are doing that. However, during 1862, the Union is not having very good luck during the Civil War. A lot of bad things are happening. They're losing battles. They're just getting beat. And Lincoln then calls up another 300,000 volunteers. And that's when Lockley succumbs to the call of being a soldier. And so he enlists. And then his sister, Emma, comes to live with Elizabeth and those three little girls to take care of them while he's gone soldiering. And that's kind of how we get to that point. And he, prior to that, he had been working on in copy editing. He worked in connection with Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper in the late 1850s, actually wrote a couple of editorials for Horace Greeley and his New York Tribune. But he never really, you know, got established. And so that's what led him into the book trade, which he hated. He hated all the travel and that kind of thing, but he did it. And ultimately, then when he enlisted for the Union Army, he did so for a number of different reasons, not the least of which was he wanted to get away from the book trade. Heck of a way to do it, but nonetheless. And he, the regiment that he enlisted with, which became the 7th New York, a heavy artillery regiment, was assigned to the defense of Washington. And that's where he was for 2 years. Wow.
Because when she took, when Elizabeth married, then she takes over as parenting his three children, and then they had their own, and she's a young woman, and they begin to correspond. I read that his letters were about what was happening around him and during the war, and her letters were about her dealing with becoming a new parent, raising children, like, they weren't intimate in nature, but they were sharing their feelings back and forth of where they were at that moment, correct?
That's correct. Yes, very definitely. He is clearly her intellectual superior simply because he's self-educated, but he is so widely read and retains what he's read so well and like that. But so at first, her letters, she is quite self-conscious of all of that. And two, they have been, they've only been married for less than a year and a half. And during that time, he was selling books door to door and he would be gone for 1-2 weeks, maybe a month. And so during that time, they don't have a lot of opportunity to really get to know each other that well. They do get to know each other very, very well through their Civil War correspondence. Now, over the 3 years that he was a soldier, he actually was able to come home only a couple of times during that 3 years. So they are really getting to know each other mainly through these letters. When he enlisted for the Army, of course, she was distraught. My God, now, you know, you're going to go away. I'm 17 years old, soon to turn 18, and have these three little girls. And I don't know anything about mothering. I know nothing about parenting, you know, and then you're leaving. So he promised her that he would write twice a week. And she promised that she would do the same. And for the most part, they did. And so that's what produced so many of those letters, that they corresponded faithfully with each other. And there is an evolution of that correspondence over time. She becomes far more mature, more secure in what she's doing. And of course, he longs for home. He provides her with suggestions and that kind of thing. She invites that. It's a back and forth. It's an exchange. And as they reach the end of the war and he is able to come home, they are really two different people by that time. And that difference and how that difference evolved is shows up through the letters.
Because I was going to ask you, if she's 17, the end of the war, end of his time, 3 years later, now she's in her 20s, early 20s. The maturity, did her letters, because you saw them, did they evolve? Like with the things that she, because I would assume he was still writing about the things that were going on around him, and he's 30 years old already, in his 30s already, but she's maturing. Did her letters evolve? Like when you read them, did they change? Could you see the maturity change and her evolution change from 17 to 20 in the way her writing styles or what she was talking about?
Very definitely. Very definitely. She becomes more mature. She becomes more secure as time goes on. And in fact, by 1864 and 65, she is taking a remarkable interest in political affairs and makes comments in her letters about battles that are held and about generals who are directing the Union Army and like that. And she actually makes assessments that historians today would very much agree with. She is alive to all of that. She starts attending political meetings, even though that was something that most women didn't do. But she just wanted to be involved. And he even says at one point in 1864, as the presidential election is coming on them, you know, who are you going to vote for? As if she could vote. And of course, I think if she had been able to vote, she would have.
So the war's over. He returns. He returns to a different woman or more mature. Did they stay married? Did they have a difficult time after he returned?
From what I can tell now, when he returned, mm-hmm. and then, for example, the letters, when he's mustered out in June of 1865, the letters stop because right. he's gone home. There's no reason for them to be writing back and forth. But they resume in September and early October that year when he goes to Cleveland. And so there's a flurry of letters before she moves from Albany to join him in Cleveland. 3 years later, when he moves to Leavenworth, Kansas, the same thing happens. There's a flurry of letters. And then when he's on the road reporting on Indian Territory, he's writing home. And so there are those letters. And she was very faithful. She was religious in saving all of these letters. And so whenever he moves, like for when he moved to Salt Lake City. There's a flurry of correspondence because she's back in Kansas, and so he's writing to her. Unfortunately, I don't have her letters that she was writing back to him, just references in his letters to her letters, so I know that they're corresponding. But she's saving all of his letters, and some of the most used letters in the Huntington collection are five that Fred Lockley wrote to her when he traveled to southern Utah actually report on the first trial of John D. Lee, who eventually was convicted of the Mountain Meadows Massacre murders. And like that, he reported on that trial. But when he was in Beaver, Utah, he was writing back to his wife, giving descriptions and color on the trial itself. And of course, the Mountain Meadows Massacre has received incredible historical attention. And so those letters are probably the most used out of the Huntington collection.
How long were did they grow old together?
Yes, very definitely. He lived until 1905. And now keep in mind, he was born in 1824, on the last day of 1824, so call it 1825. She was born in 1843. So he's certainly 18 years, more than 18 years older than she is. And so when he dies in 1905, she's still got quite a bit of life left. She lives until the 1920s and then passes away in the late 1920s. But they stayed together the whole time. The marriage was strong all the way through. There was one blip in it when they were in Butte, Montana. They had a child that then died in infancy, and that was probably the roughest time of their marriage, because she went back to her family in New York, upstate New York, and was gone for the better part of a year. And but they then rejoined and like that, and lived their lives together until he passed away.
Now, where is he buried and where is she buried? Do you know?
Yes, they're both buried in a cemetery in Salem, Oregon.
I'm gonna have to make a road trip.
Although he actually died in Missoula, Montana. He was in the upstairs bedroom of the of his daughter's house. She had married an architect, a Missoula architect who actually is fairly well known today because he designed a number of the buildings on the University of Montana campus.
Was there anything in the letters that you read? I would assume you read them all.
Or I did.
Was there anything in the letters that surprised you the most, where like you took away something from it where you're like, wow, that letter affected me more than all others?
Yes, there are a number of letters like that that I found particularly poignant, particularly if not wise, certainly amazingly perceptive. Excuse me, probably. Certainly one of the most moving letters in the collection, and it's in the book, is their exchange of letters immediately following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. As you know, Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater on a Friday night and then died on a Saturday morning, and Lockley then attends church that Sunday morning, which is Easter, and then goes back to his unit and writes a letter to Elizabeth that explains his feelings, and it's an extraordinarily moving letter. And interestingly enough, she's doing exactly the same thing on that Sunday. And so those letters cross in the mail and like that. So you've got both of their feelings and their experiences and their responses to this assassination, which of course took the country by incredible, you know, surprise and mourning.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, if you're wondering who we're talking to Charles Rankin. He's written a book that's called Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. It's published through University of Nebraska Press. You can find it on Amazon and booksellers near you for around $35, about 425 pages. I can't wait to get this one into my collection and read it. And I hope that you'll enjoy it as much as I enjoy Charles talking about it, because it sounds fascinating. Just fantastic book. We only have about 4 minutes left. Normally, I'll ask people about a time machine, and I'll say, if you could go back into time, would there, you know, is there anything that you'd like to see or do? You couldn't get involved in time. You couldn't get involved in it. And they'll give me an answer. I'm not really going to give you the time machine question today. More of all the research that you've done and reading of the letters, was there any spot in those letters, any place that you said, my God, I wish I was there? I wish I could.
Definitely, definitely. One of the themes that courses through the book very, very strongly and amazingly so, is relatively rare in Civil War letters, although there are lots of references in letters, but these letters develop it more, which has to do with parenting and children. Every letter that they write seems to have some connection with what the children are doing, what the girls are doing, and like that. And there are a couple of letters in the collection that Frederick wrote to his daughter Dolly, which have survived, and those are extremely moving because he is not condescending in the least. He is totally right up front and explaining to her how, you know, he had mishaps and some are his fault. He gets caught in shelling, but and tells her all about it. And that sort of thing. There are a number of instances, however, and every historian feels this way, that if I could go back and just sit down with them for just a few minutes, much less, you know, an hour, a day, whatever, so many questions to ask, because even though you have this tremendous cache of historical material from which to draw an understanding of their story, there are still questions. There are still multiple questions as to that just don't get answered. And you wish they would.
Well, this hour went by super fast. Will you come back and do another one?
Sure.
Okay. Because I got more. Maybe we'll probably have to do it. We didn't even talk about the book cover, and I want to talk about the book cover. So we'll get them back. Maybe we'll make them the first podcast for 2024. Again, we're talking to Charles Rankin. You can find him and his book, Toward a More Perfect Union, The Civil War Letters of Frederick and Elizabeth Lockley. You can find it at Amazon and booksellers near you, again, for around $35, 425 plus pages. You're going to want to get this one added to your collection. We're going to have him back because I didn't even ask him about the book cover. And I want to do that. Again, I want to thank everybody for making 2023 an insane year. We did 34 podcasts this year. We're going to be booking right into 2024 and continuing on. I appreciate all my followers out there. There's 400 and something of you on Spotify. If I could reach out to every one of you, I would, and thank you. Please go to wherever you listen, Spotify, iHeartRadio, iTunes, wherever. Please leave a rating and a review. Even if it says Mike sucks, I don't, you know, like, I don't care. Don't leave that. But I do appreciate it because it's important for the getting out the content. And the second reason is because iTunes has got us rated as an educational with a clean rating. So that means that anybody out there that has grandchildren or children and they're in the car and you're like, hey, we're going to listen to a podcast, and you don't have to worry about any foul language or anything out there going crazy. You get some great interviews with historians, researchers, and writers like Charles. There's 89 podcasts, I think, 89 hours of podcasts, I think. And we'll have more. We're going to hit the 100 mark next year. But they're out there. They're out there for you to listen to and learn a little bit and not have to worry about foul language or any of the crazy stuff that's going on in the world today. It's just straight Western history and Civil War history. This is my first Civil War podcast. Of course, I want to thank the Tombstone Epitaph always being there, Mark Boardman and Eric Wright. They actually helped me with getting the guests scheduled and introducing me, and they send me their emails, and they make a lot of first contact for me. So that's why I promote the Tombstone Epitaph at tombstoneepitaph.com. And of course, my second family at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. They do the same thing. A lot of people there, John Bosnecker and Eddie and Pam and David Guyton, they're all working hard to get Western history to you through Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. So please, if you're into any of those three spots, go hit the like button, subscribe button, and follow along. And the Wild West History Association, they help me with bookings as well and getting me emails to all these amazing researchers and writers and historians that you hear here. So I appreciate them a bunch. Anything to add, sir, before we go? Got a minute?
I don't. we've covered a lot of bases, but obviously there are more. I would say this. The reward on the letters is beyond what most Civil War letters books offer. I have read quite a few in preparation of this book. These letters really are high quality. They aren't, it's not, it rained today, it snowed today, I was sick today. It's not that at all. There are a lot of themes that course through them, and they're extraordinarily well written.
All right. Well, there you go. That's reason enough for me. Of course, I want to thank University of Nebraska Press and Sarah Key. She's the bomb. I just dig her, and I appreciate her always being there and helping me out with getting some terrific people on the podcast channel, just like you hear Charles today. As always, until safe travels, happy new year, and we'll see you in 2024.